stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
Do 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 do. Daytona! Oh my God! What the hell did I just watch? Welcome to Motorsport 101.
You are the world champion!
Hi guys, I'm Andre Harrison, and welcome to episode 123 of me corpsing RJ's ridiculous intros, and apparently the Motorsport 101 podcast as well. Thanks for listening, as always, and with me, you probably already heard in the intro, he's probably still recovering his vocal cords back. He's Nashville's finest. He's RJ O'Connell.
Thank you. I'm just here keeping tabs on everything Winter Olympics related. As of right now, it's 7-4 Korea in the eighth frame. Of what sport, you ask? It could be anything. It could be biathlon, cross country. It could be ice hockey. It could be curling. It's curling.
Yeah. it's funny, like, we also just cracked some jokes before this show started. I have a little bit of a fun joke in here, right? Before we started talking this, we are all big fans of the OSW Review podcast. And we joked,
welcome,
right,
to our review of Sunny Side Up starring Tammy Lynn Sitch.
Right, look, that was a thing, right? And we talked about it.
We have to mention that it's OSW's review of Sunny Side Up, because if we just mentioned just Sunny Side Up, we have to mention that this is now an explicit podcast.
Yeah, well, it's on iTunes, I know it's explicit, but that was a thing, and Zoe asked, what's Sunny Side Up? And we all just died laughing, which is funny, because the person who just tweeted us literally 5 seconds ago was Jay Hunter himself.
We just got the rub!
Who just tweeted us, ha, thanks guys, and yes, don't, laugh emoji. The night is dark and full of terrors. Jay Hunter, we love you, man.
At least I know not to wear my Hall of Fame ring whenever I'm doing something like that if the money gets tight. Which the money will never get tight because of all of our support for our Patreon backers at patreon.com/motorsport101.
Jay, we love you, man. You're awesome. And if you're a wrestling fan and you're not listening to the OSW Review podcast, where the hell have you been? Basically, they are hilarious and we love them so. So props, guys. And Jay, I don't know how you got through editing that. Good man. But he's also one of the nicest guys on all of Twitter. So Jay and the crew, awesome. Also on the show is, well, he's a guy that is in deep emotional grieving because of the worst American Olympic performance, apparently, in 24 years. Oh, and also his beloved Michaela Schifrin not picking up 17 gold medals. That's Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Hi, guys. I mean, she got a gold medal. That's better than, like, most other Americans at the moment, so...
It's like the biggest Olympic disappointment since Marion Jones. Oh dear. More on the Winter Olympics in just a minute, because we're bringing back Keeping It 101 for that, because we have to talk about the Olympic Games that we do on this show. It's tradition. Just like Adam Johnson's restraining order. It's tradition.
We love you, Adam. Be sure to subscribe to Armbar Arcade on YouTube.
Of course. But in the meantime, places you can find us real quick. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101. Me and Nora beat our heads together. We were going to have podcast highlights out again very, very soon. Most likely next week onwards. Just look forward to some of those. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter @motorsport_101. And if you'd like to follow us there, personally, we are @Harrison101HD, @RyanEricKing, that's with two Ks, and @RJOConnell. And of course, if you really, really like us, you can back us on Patreon @patreon.com/motorsport101. Just $5 gets you early access to both this show and Bike Live, which, literally about 10 minutes ago, I released a new episode of. Isn't that fun? It's very meta. It is episode 46 of Bike Live, which is coming right now. By the time this is out, it's the episode VR46, as we like to call it, because we're witty like that. It's called The Doctor Will See You Now. It is a Valentino Rossi special talking about some of his greatest moments, some of his epic rivalries with people like Max Biaggi, Sete Gibernau, Jorge Lorenzo, Marc Marquez, and just what makes the man tick. And it's a fun time. It's a fun time.
You could even say it's a blue ribbon, Scari, a Nastro Azzurro piece of audio. Ooh.
I like that. Very cultural. But hey, I've got a little bit of breaking news for you guys out here as well. There's going to be two Bike Lives this week. Whoa! Rather than one. Yes, that's right. There will be a second Bike Live episode out this Friday. Friday the 23rd of February is a recording to this. It is going to be a 2018 World Superbike season preview as well. World Superbikes 2018 kicks off this weekend at Phillip Island. Will Jonathan Rea win his fourth consecutive title? Yeah. Brackets, probably. But hey, we have to try and make it seem like there's a more competitive season going on. All the talk about the rules, all the talk about, well, goodness knows what else, really. Honda, Leon Camier through the field. Could Yamaha be a dark horse? Ducati in their V4 Panigale hype. Spanish Elvis with MV Agusta this time. That's always fun. And we've got a special guest coming in. Greg Haynes is back as well. Just like you wanted our first episode of the reboot. We've got Greg Haynes back as well for that episode, episode 47. And I'm not going to be in that episode. But there's a very special replacement in mind. You'll see what I mean when the episode goes out on Friday. Keep half an eye on that. In the meantime, let's have a quick musical interlude and let's get into Keeping It 101. The first Keeping It 101 of 2018. Ladies and gentlemen, it is good to be back. We've restoked the fires as the Winter Olympics are going down in Pyeongchang. And King, like, have you mourned sufficiently over the tragic American performance yet?
Oh, God. It's hard to break down to people who haven't been following the Winter Olympic Games. The United States is not where the United States usually is. Well, usually for the most recent Olympic Games, where it's not only we're not winning, we're not getting medals, period. Where Lindsay Jacob Ellis fails to medal in border cross, Michaela Schifrin fails to win a medal in her signature event, the slalom, Lindsey Vonn fails to medal in Super G, Nathan Chen fails to medal in men's figure skating. It's a lot of not getting medals.
Like, if our man, like, Charlie Regenbull was here, he'd be so stunting right now with Canada being so up there. And I think they're second or first in the medal table right now.
Yeah, they're third in the medal table.
The third. Okay, so took the third a little bit there. Still, like, I think they're at 11 gold medals right now, which is crazy. The Canadians are out here for a fun time. But hey, King, at least Sean White came through, right?
Yeah, at least Sean White came through.
As did Chloe Kim. Chloe Kim, yes, got herself a gold medal. Chloe Kim, yes, is... Chloe Kim is just, I'll say this in advance, Chloe Kim is fantastic.
Oh, she's fantastic. She's amazing.
She's American hope personified.
I love that woman so much. She won the snowboard halfpipe gold medal, and she was incredible. She blitzed the field, blew them away. But she was also, she got a bit of viral popularity for tweeting during the event itself. And talking about how she missed her breakfast sandwich and now she was, quote-unquote, hangry. Not hungry, hangry. And when asked why she didn't cry on the podium after receiving her gold medal, she said, and I quote, "I spent too much time on my eyeliner. I love this girl."
Yeah. It was a medal that was 4 years in the waiting, because a lot of people kind of forget this about the last Olympic Games. She would have been the favorite at the last Olympic Games if she was old enough to compete by the IOC rules.
In other words, she was 13 back then, and she was leading favorite to win.
Yeah, yeah.
That's That's terrifying. That's... my nuts hadn't even dropped at 13, and you're talking about being an Olympic gold medal favourite. Like, come on, man.
Y'all, like, can we also talk about some of the more ridiculous things that happen? Like, the fact that you can be a dual sport athlete in this Olympics and still kick ass at it. Take, for instance, Esther Ledecka.
Oh my god, that is an amazing story about how she... I'm just going to have a go at this, basically. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't she not borrow your hero skis, King?
Yep.
And then she goes and wins the gold medal! I love it!
I'm surprised with their similar last names that Darren Revelle did not tweet out an Esther Ledecka-tariot. to recycle his worst tweet from 2016.
That would have been a beautiful, beautiful thing, but that might have been like... I saw criticism for the American coverage because they were so sure that someone outside of the top 20 wasn't going to win that they didn't actually broadcast the run itself that would actually inevitably end up winning the gold medal. That, which I thought, was actually quite funny.
Yes.
So I thought that was quite funny in its own right. And hey, even Great Britain's had its moments because, hey, Lizzie Yarnold retained their Olympic skeleton title.
Oh.
Woo!
I have not watched enough downhill, like, sliding sports for my own liking, and I feel like I missed out because, man, I love me some bobsled, I love me some luge, and especially I love me some skeleton.
Yeah, the idea of, like, Britain dominating in a sport where we slide down on what's a glorified tea tray, I think, is the most British thing of all time. Lizzie even named her sled. She even named it Mervyn, which is like the most British thing you could possibly imagine. And she set a new track record on the final run to win gold by nearly half a second. That woman is a total gangster.
Yeah, and considering the medal projection from before the games, Britain actually has 25% more medals than most projections thought they would have.
Right, like, but the funny thing is, it's still kind of a disappointing games for us. It's really weird because we have a gold and three bronzes because, we got gold and bronze in the women's skeleton because Laura Dees, Lizzie Yarnold's teammate, got the bronze, which caused our commentators to literally have an epileptic fit in the commentary, which I thought was also hilarious. If you haven't seen it, go on BBC Sports Twitter page and scroll down a bit. You'll find it. It's a gem. Amy Williams is a delight. And she was our champion in 2010, I believe it was, in Vancouver. But yeah, like that was hilarious. We had Don Parsons in the men's skeleton winning the bronze. That was a genuine, like, we were thinking, okay, outside chance, maybe a bronze if everything comes together. And we got the bronze, which was nice. So that was fun. And one of our ski slope star runners got bronze as well. So we've got a gold and three bronzes. But it's funny because, like, our Olympic coverage on BBC Sport has basically been dominated by all the coverage regarding Elise Christie. And it has been ridiculous. She was basically our number one chance of multiple gold medals because she was taking part in the 500, 1000, and 1500 meter short track speed skating. And she's had a nightmare games, basically. She was disqualified into this morning's 1000 meter race, which was her favorite event. She was coming off an injury she took when she went too hard around the outside of an athlete in the 1500, tagged the Chinese athlete, went spiraling into the wall and basically damaged the ligaments in her leg, which would normally put you on the shelf for 4 to 6 weeks, apparently. But they rushed her back like 3 days later to try and take part in the 1000, and it just didn't go to plan. She was yellow carded and disqualified anyway. And she was taken out in the 500 meter final. So it's like back to back Olympic Games.
Like roughly based on, you know, the think tank over at 538, they projected that she wasn't going to win any medals.
Wow, they called their shot.
Yeah, they projected that Britain would win 4 medals, 1 gold, but Christie would get no medals.
they actually saw it coming. It's like that is hilarious and cruel yet hilarious, because it's like the running narrative was that she also got disqualified and crashed out in all three of her events at the 2014 games as well. So it's now back-to-back games for Elise Christie. She had it bad after the 2014 game. She almost retired from the sport altogether because of the abuse she got for taking out one of the home athletes. But since then, she's now like, what, I think she's a three-time world champion, but nobody really cares about the world titles compared to the Olympics. That's the one where everyone's watching. And yeah, she's now 0 for 6 in Olympic events in the short track. And it's just like, If you watch the BBC coverage, I swear to God, they were playing her exit interviews every 15 minutes. It was it was utterly infuriating. Claire Boldin, who is normally one of our finest sports broadcasters and is normally fantastic, was fueling the conspiracy theory fire. Like, are the judges out to get her? And then, like, even the expert pundits were like, come on now, they disqualified a South Korean athlete from the gold medal position. These guys aren't biased. It's like, they were willing to piss off the hometown fans. And as we've seen earlier, they can be quite aggressive, basically. But yeah, it's been the Elise Christie show, and it's been really infuriating to watch these games on the BBC. Like, I'm not just going to watch...
Yeah. Are we ready for USA versus Canada round whatever the fuck this is in women's ice hockey? Because I sure am.
114.
They absolutely whipped ass in the semifinals.
We need this. America needs this.
We are very excited about the hockey tournament, where we're guaranteed to at least have the best players in their respective fields competing in the tournament.
Oh yeah,
right.
Background on why this Olympics has been so crazy for basically everyone. Number one, the Russian Federation got banned from competing. Russian athletes could compete in the games, but number one, their medals would not count to Russia's historical totals. Two, the Russian flag would not be raised if a Russian won gold or any medal, and the Russian anthem wouldn't be played if a Russian
athlete won. That's fine, when Evgenia Medjeva wins all of the women's figure skating gold medals, they can just play the Sailor Moon theme on the podium, and that's perfectly fine. Medjeva is the only Russian athlete that we trust in these games. Maybe Ilya Kovalchuk. That's about it.
So Russians could compete in these games, but they had to have to pretty much not have been caught doping before, and to pretty much adhere to the strictest anti-doping regime the IOC could come up with.
Right.
To the point where one of the Russians who did compete at these games did get caught doping in curling.
How do you dope in curling?
Very carefully.
Why? For what? For who? No. Please, I need to sweep faster. Please, I need to dope so I have faster twitch muscle fibers in my arms for when I inevitably sweep this stone out of the key. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Like, a Russian gets done for doping in the fucking curling.
Dope. Literally.
Yeah. Icarus 2, the curling edition. The Winter Games edition. Oh my god. That is ridiculous. Oh my god. Like,
I don't even... Like, why? Why?
I don't understand that at all. Also, like, I love the internet speculation we've had on the internet in some time over Tessa Virtue and Scott Moore in the figure skating as well, who were just so friggin' good. Everybody thinks they must be in love with each other. I mean, that's like the cutest yet weirdest thing I've ever read about all this. Like,
oh god, Dre, you know what he tested positive for?
What's that?
Melatonin, the same substance that Maria Sharapova tested positive for.
Oh no! Sharapova's. Oh no. Was it from a ridiculously sweet line of confectionery, or was it just the
I don't know. And we do have to talk about the men's hockey side of things, where this is also the Olympic Games, where the NHL decided that none of their athletes would be allowed to participate in this Olympic Games.
Yeah, this is why you see PK Subban playing in Nashville right now instead of playing in Pyeongchang. But that's fine, because my team still has a little bit of piece of itself in the Olympics, because Eli Tolvanen, at 18 years old, is leading the men's hockey tournament in scoring. The Predators are going to get him in the stretch run of the playoffs. Oh, it's going to make the inevitable Stanley Cup Finals loss more painful to bear.
Get PK a goddamn championship ring. Like,
We're trying our best, man.
If it doesn't happen, RJ, I will beat the Super Saiyan Blue out of you. Like, I'll hold you personally responsible.
Let's see. Any other stories from the games? Well, this will actually be the first games in a very long time where a certain country might be on the top of the medal table at the end, where it looks like it's either going to be the Norwegians or the Germans on the top of the medal count at the game's end.
You mean Norway? They mean the country of the curly team with the fancy pants?
Like, Norway is like, I'd expect them to be at the top of the medal table. Germany, I'm like, whoa, is this the 1930s?
Yeah, they're killing it in all the downhill events, like the luge, the bobsleigh, and the skeleton. They've been crushing it over there. So yeah, I'm not entirely surprised by Germany, if I must say, but Norway, I'm like, whoa, okay. Like somewhere, FizzyFan91 is like fist pumping relentlessly in his bedroom, talking about their
inevitable success. Pants.
The curling pants are fantastic, I have to say. Like, props to the Norwegians for their great sense of humour. But, it's been a fun games. And, we're coming towards the end of it. Now this is day 12, I believe, now. So we're coming up towards the business end of things. But it's been a fun time, as always.
Yes, indeed. As the great Justin McElroy once said, "Ooh, baby, gotta have my limps."
Gotta have my limps.
Yes, sir.
There's still, you know, events to look forward to. We're day 9, so what other events we have left?
We're at day 12, mate.
Oh, 12? Oh, yeah. Wow. So
it's going quick.
America's sweetheart Adam Rippon no longer having to compete. I believe the men's figure skating side of things is done.
Yeah, women's downhill is today.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. more chance for disappointment.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I hope she picks up like a really petty bronze, like just to make you feel like really on the fence about the whole thing. After your mocking of me like midweek last week when I was watching the Grand Talking, like I hope Schifrin like completely shits the bed.
Wow. Thanks, Dre. Day 13 we have the men's and women's short track again.
Yes.
Day 14, nothing. Women's figure skating, women's big air snowboarding. That's going to be fun.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be great.
And, yeah, the last day of the games. Oh, yeah, last day, men's and women's mass start on the big oval.
Oh, no. I'm on my hands like Birdman at the very thought of this. This is going to be great.
And obviously the finals of the men's ice hockey tournament.
Oh yeah, like there might be blood on this podcast in 2 weeks' time if America doesn't bring that one home.
Oh, men's ice? No, men's ice. Like we're done. We're not getting a medal.
The women's side, however.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be blood involved there because, again, you have the best players in the tournament in the women's hockey game. Men's side, we have Brian Gionta on our team. Brian Gianta's 40.
Yeah.
40. Good lord.
Just so you know, the United States, we barely made it out of our group. But we did destroy Slovakia, so we're actually into the quarterfinals.
There is hope. There is hope for
right
America.
Right now,
yes.
It's shaping up that there will be a semifinal. We're heading towards a semifinal. If the United States can somehow beat the Czech Republic, we're in to a semifinal against the boys from Russia. I can't say the Russian Federation. I have the boys from Russia.
But
literally the boys from Russia.
But that's
the,
all right.
The Olympic athletes from Russia.
But that's okay, because when you have the great Bork on the U.S. men's team, how could you lose? That's not Raymond. That's Raymond's son, Chris.
Canada's quarterfinal matchup is against Finland. If they win, they'll be in a semifinal against Sweden and Germany.
Sounds hype.
Yep. Who's ready for disappointment?
I've always been ready for disappointment. Are you kidding me?
You tell him, bro.
Disappointment's my middle name.
Ever the bright and cheery one, aren't you, man? Right. Shall we talk about some motorsport, fellas?
Oh, yeah, we're talking about Eric Almirola's disappointment.
Yep, let's get into, after this quick musical break, the Daytona 500.
Everybody, break out your Smithfield bacon and pull up and open a box of Pizza Hut. It's time to talk about Daytona Day. But wait, Dre, you don't have any mango juice, do you?
Sadly, the mango juice, like I had to go dry. I had to go without mango juice on this year's occasion.
Out of this one.
Mostly. Yeah, I wasn't out of it. I watched I didn't watch stage two, but I did watch stages one and three. I was busy watching the Lease Christie fall over for the 15th time on BBC Sports.
Savage.
Well, hey, if you like people falling over in catastrophic manners, then the Daytona 500, especially at the end of these stages, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly, it's a great format for that. You just pop in and out, like you go. I'm gonna go shopping. I'm gonna come back home and then check back in for the last 20 laps. And it was a fun time. Apparently, tell us more, RJ.
Okay, so basically we had restrictor plate racing. This is like ultra condensed pack racing. You have cars that are a lot faster and a lot more difficult to drive because they're slammed to the ground lower. And a lot of people were taking a lot of chances. So let's start with stage one, where we had a big old pileup to end the first segment of the race. And then we get to stage two, where we had another big pileup to end the second stage. And then we get to the finish. Now,
What happened? Was there another giant wreck that had an effect on the outcome?
Oh yeah,
it wasn't really a giant wreck. It was a small wreck that involved the most important people,
which
are the people in front. Now, just to set the scene here. Now, Ryan Blaney, new Penske recruit, soon to be star of the Penske Games, although he was on Penske Games season one. He was kicking a lot of ass in this race. He led more than half of the laps. We get to the final 10 laps of the race, and he's mixing it up with the field. He gets a run on defending race winner Kurt Busch in the middle of the pack. He gets a run. He's not going to lift. Busch makes a move down, and then that pretty much takes Ryan Blaney out of contention with too much damage. By the way, stage one, we took out 7-time champion Jimmy Johnson and rookie sensation William Byron all in the same swoop, and Eric Jones, who was having a tremendous race up to that point. They all got taken out. Stage two, we had pre-race odds-on favorite Brad Keselowski. Chase Elliott got taken out in a massive head-on crash. But
somehow wasn't any Hanneman's fault for once.
Yes, I believe Ricky Stenhouse was also involved in one of these. Kevin Harvick was taken out, but...
Yeah. Stenhouse almost caused the first one as well when he nearly lost. He had a fantastic save, but then Jones did not, and that's what caused that enormous stage one wreck. I reckon Stenhouse may have been distracted by who was behind
but
him.
We lost the biggest part of the race in stage two.
Who?
As billions of Americans tuned out when they saw that green and black GoDaddy number 7 get wiped out in the wreck. Danica Patrick in her last race for 3 months.
No!
In fairness,
literally 175 million people may or may not have tuned out.
89 billion viewers tuned out. That's why the overnight ratings were so bad, folks.
Of course.
It wasn't just the fact of a sport being in recession, having to rebuild around a whole bunch of new talent all at once with the retirement of the most popular driver, who, by the way, gave a stirring command to start engines, by the way.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he's going to be a great broadcaster, guys. He's already in Pontiac for the Winter Olympic Games, which is crazy.
I love Dale. I love Dale so much. He's too awesome.
Oh my goodness. Yes, but Danica Patrick got taken out of stage two.
No!
So Ryan Blaney holds the lead until two laps to go when Kurt Busch spins in front of him, collects Blaney and 11 other cars, including, among others, Reddit's favorite driver, Matt DiBenedetto, who was running in the top five.
Dina Burrito!
Yes!
Oh my goodness, it was...
Future NASCAR Heat Evolution cover star.
I don't think he drives for Toyota, though. Okay, so we get to the overtime stage. This is basically the green-white checker. And basically, to just simplify the overly complicated explanation is, we give you two laps to complete one lap. If you can make one lap, we can finish the race. If we can't, we'll try this again. We'll try it as many times as it takes. In the Xfinity race, they had to try it 5 times.
Shout out to Henry Chapman for dropping me that one. I was like, I had no idea that was a thing.
And shout out to Tyler Reddick for winning by 2/10,000ths of a second. Golly.
Yikes.
We get to Denny Hamlin leading on the restart. He doesn't get such a good start. And Eric Almirola from Tampa takes the lead in the car that was once Danica Patrick's. And all is looking...
He was clear.
Yes, he was clear. And then the final lap comes around. And who comes charged up behind him but Austin Dillon in the famous Richard Childress number 3 Chevy and Darrell Wallace Jr. in the famous number 43 of Richard Petty Motorsport. They get a run. Dillon is not going to lift as they're going into turn 3. Almirola's going to cover that open gap, and what happens? Almirola gets punted, and Austin Dillon drives on to win the race, and everybody is upset.
Is this one of those welcome to NASCAR moments where if casual viewers who don't normally watch NASCAR tuned in would quite rightly be pissed off when they realize that's just how NASCAR is and has always been a thing? Is that the long and the short of it here?
Yes and no. Well,
go on, King. Give me some context.
The part is, yes, you'd be pissed because in any other racing series, that would be pretty much a penalty for avoidable contact. And pretty much...
NASCAR, avoidable contact.
Yeah, pretty much like it would have been declared a yellow flag. Austin Dillon would have been either penalized or disqualified, and Eric Almirola would have been awarded the victory, but this is NASCAR. That ain't gonna happen.
Not a hope in hell.
Old-time NASCAR, probably Austin Dillon still would have won the race, because... RJ, when did they introduce the rule where a caution froze the field and you didn't have to race to the yellow?
That would be late 2003, was it not?
Yeah, so under those rules, a caution didn't, freeze the field immediately. You still had to, run to the finish line, then the caution started.
Right.
Under that circumstances, Austin Dillon still would have won the race.
Yeah, and aren't we coming up on the 40th anniversary of NASCAR's breakthrough watershed moment in the mainstream, which was precipitated by, get this, two guys literally trying to drive each other off the road down the backstretch and taking each other out into turn 3 so that Richard Petty could win from a half a lap behind them.
Yes. that did happen. But again,
the first episode of Motorsport 101 Fight Club, by the way, the very first in America. It all started there. Carry on, King.
But yeah, that situation, racing at Daytona was much different back then, where the fact that the next car behind the lead two was half a lap behind.
Yeah.
Times have changed.
You didn't have plate racing. You did not have cars that could go this fast, this close together. And people were taking a lot of chances. I told my buddy Brian Hughes, who works as a ring announcer for Nova Pro Wrestling up in Northern Virginia. Give them a shout, by the way. They're a really awesome promotion. I told my buddy Brian that if this race is not going to finish clean, sure as shit, it did not finish clean. It didn't even finish clean behind Austin Dillon taking the checkered flag. Because if in the hypothetical situation where he'd been excluded for that avoidable contact, we would have had the closest Daytona 500 finish ever when Darrell Wallace Jr. beat Denny Hamlin to the line by about an inch.
Yeah. Whew. Oh my god, that was so ridiculously close. It was insane.
If that was the finish, it would be a completely different story.
Oh yeah. I think the official time was 4/10,000ths of a second between them.
Yes.
On a photo, NASCAR can go to 5 decimal places. 4/10,000ths of a second between them over that, which is about an inch from what I've been told at that speed. Welcome to the Bubba Appreciation Space, I suppose.
Welcome to the Bubba Wallace Jr. Appreciation Hour, the first black driver in NASCAR to race full-time since Wendell Scott in the early 60s. And he kicked ass. He was great in his dual race. He was consistently up at the front. Hell, he could have won this thing on his debut.
Yeah, he led final practice. He was the fastest car out there after final practice.
He had a car that has a technical alliance with the team that won it.
Yeah.
It's bonkers. It is bonkers. And he was fantastic. Again, a career-high second-place finish. He's gotten better every single time he's been in the car, which I thought was another cool factoid as well.
He got a call on pit road from Henry Aaron. He got a Twitter shout-out from Lewis Hamilton.
Right.
And then his mother, after the race, came up to him in tears during the press conference, and they shared a hug. And I'm just like, I'm not crying, you are. Who's cutting onions?
I choked up watching that. It was a beautiful scene, and his diss of Denny Hamlin in the post race interview was a thing of beauty.
Now this requires some context because Denny sure. Hamlin had, not to glorify a media outlet that we wouldn't condone of, but let's say Denny Hamlin just pulled himself up by the bar and sat himself down at the stool to say that. Over 70% of NASCAR drivers use Adderall. We don't know whether he was serious or whether he was just trying to, you know, have some banter. But then after reviewing the incident between Bubba Wallace looks at the incident and is like, I don't know about that. I think he may need some Adderall after the race.
So what exactly is Adderall for? I just Wikipedia'd it. Oh, it's for treating the symptoms of ADHD and narcolepsy. Ah, yeah, now I see why that was such a sick burn. Oh boy. Oh boy.
Oh gosh. Whew. And honestly, Darrell Wallace Jr. is like the star that NASCAR has needed for a while.
Right.
It's been a while since NASCAR could honestly say that they have a star that people outside of the sport like genuinely care about. I would say that it's been a while since Dale Jr. was definitely one of those figures. Jeff Gordon in the late 90s was one of those figures. It's been a while.
And this is from a sport that desperately needs it because, again, you have that generation of drivers who were part of NASCAR's that last boom period in the late 90s, early 2000. You know, the likes of Jeff Gordon and now Dale Earnhardt Jr., Matt Kenseth have stepped away just in the last year. This is a sport that needs to rebuild itself around new talent. And yes, you have guys who are ultra-talented, like Carl Larson, like Chase Elliott, Eric Jones, like William Byron, who just had an absolute drizzling shit of first race cup, by the way. But Darrell Wallace Jr. has that it factor. He has something that connects with he connects with well outside the sport, and he could be like a star who changes the face of the sport in general.
Yeah, like
absolutely.
He's the kind of guy that can connect with someone at a dirt track on Saturday night or Wednesday afternoon on the Ellen DeGeneres show. He's that kind of person.
Right, just like an infectious level of charisma and just the sort of person where it's like if when he talks you listen, and yeah, just you know, not afraid to be emotional, not afraid to be passionate, articulate, etc. It's like he blew me away. That was the first time I'd seen him on a racetrack watching this Daytona 500, and I was blown away by all those personality traits that he has, and that is a guy that could easily be the face of a sport one day. That's the immediate impression that I got from watching him. So, yeah, twin that in with a terrific second place and getting one over on Denny Hamlin, who is one of the sport's leading anti-villains at the moment. And, good weekend for Bubba, so to speak, on that one. Also, I still need mango juice, like effective immediately. but any other takeaways from Daytona, RJ, besides your strained vocal cords?
Goodness. What other takeaways did I have from this? Do we need to rethink plate racing? Do we need to rethink plate racing? Because in general, you know, that was a whole lot of. I was amazed that there were not worse wrecks that came out of the way that some people were driving, especially to defender position. Like, I appreciate the job that Ryan Blaney did. He kicked ass, and he absolutely deserved a better finish. But he was also very block-heavy during this race, and that's what you kind of got to do to hold the lead in a restrictor plate race to begin with.
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure I spoke with RJ before this about, like, despite the fact that no car went airborne, like, those are probably some of the most violent crashes I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, for instance,
it ain't about.
Yeah, if for instance, Chase Elliott's hit was so violent that about 20 years ago, this would have seriously hurt him.
Yeah, he would have been missing a significant portion of the season.
Yeah.
Whew. Daniel Suarez's helmet cam showed pretty much the impact, and that's like with modern safety equipment attached to it.
Yeah, and
the helmet cam was fire, by the way.
Yeah, helmet cam was fire, but I think the earlier point of it where it's almost like NASCAR wants this to happen, because pretty much the description that RJ said, where pretty much every stage finish ended with a massive accident, and pretty much for NASCAR, this is not a problem.
Yeah, because with the stage, they want to have some, like, incentive in the middle of the race. They want people to just not tune out during the middle of it and then check back in for the last 20 laps. They want to bring that excitement of the finish of the race throughout the whole race itself. And I get that. And I get that drivers are driving hard for these stage points to get themselves in an advantageous position to get in front of the championship with playoff points. We saw that happen with Martin Truex Jr. last year, who won 19 stages. 19!
Yeah.
That's a lot. Jeez. That is a lot over a 36-race season, as it turns out. But I don't think it really works for plate tracks. I feel like a lot of NASCAR's rule book is built around, like, the 32 other races that they have on the calendar and not just these four. Which just so happened to be their four of their biggest drawing events.
Of course.
It's like they should have a completely different rule package for, like, these tracks, which are, by their nature, by their inherent nature, they're outliers. They're not the usual NASCAR race.
Oh, do you remember the time they tried to have pack knockout qualifying at Daytona? Oh,
yeah.
My God.
So Dre, a couple years back, NASCAR decided we're going to go down the Formula One route and have knockout qualifying.
That's great. That is really awesome.
That is great on a track that is, you know, decently sized, and you can have the cars spaced out and spread out. But in plate racing conditions, it benefits you to run with other cars. You go faster in a group.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous.
So naturally, we had a whole lot of wrecking.
Yeah, like it was chaos. So basically, what NASCAR did was, they still have group qualifying, but they still have the traditional, you know, single car goes out there for the plate races. So, I think they should expand that thinking to the actual races themselves, where this is completely different than anything else we do. We should kind of come up with a rules package to, specifically designed to handle this environment.
I don't understand why they still have the restricted plate. I know why they have it. It's to slow the cars down. But my thinking was, when they went to the fuel-injected engine with the standard McLaren ECU, I was thinking, right, we can have a rev limiter.
Yeah, we could do literally what IndyCar does at Indianapolis, where to avoid the cars going too fast, they have, you know, a rev limiter, pretty much the boost pressure will go down once you pass a certain RPM, so you still have the lower end speed and acceleration without the danger of extremely high speeds at the top end.
Yeah, because honestly, it's getting to the point where it's just like, is a one car 220 mile an hour wreck really that much more dangerous than a 15 car 190 mile an hour wreck?
Yeah, and especially what we know now about concussions, like, pretty much, I'd rather have one crash with one impact than a massive pack crash where I'm probably taking five or six different impacts.
And especially with the safety advances that we've had since 1987, the last time we've had plate racing. By the way, there's one other takeaway. There's a very good 30-minute documentary on NASCAR legend Tim Richmond and his attempt to come back to racing and run the 1988 Daytona 500 while he was still battling trouble with getting himself medically cleared to run. And it's a very interesting documentary. It was posted by NASCAR Man on YouTube. It's told in the style of, I want to say it was the 30th or 30 about June 16th, 1994. It was the day where we had the Stanley Cup celebration and the OJ chase and the NBA finals all going on at once. It was told using like archival footage entirely. And it's a good watch.
Wow.
Tim Richmond, by the way, one of the most underappreciated characters in NASCAR, because he was the Hollywood type ultra flashy showman that the sport wouldn't have for like another 10 years afterwards.
Yeah. Pretty much, he was the guy who could have made NASCAR into a product that could compete with the likes of CART at that time, but for obvious reasons, Tim Richmond's career ended very abruptly.
Right, because he had what we had thought was pneumonia and drug problems, it turned out he had contracted AIDS in 1987, and this was at a time where people's attitude towards HIV and AIDS was not very good. If you ask certain people, they'll tell you that Tim Richmond was deliberately run out of the sport because of this. At any rate, we'll never really know the truth, but Tim Richmond should have had a much better career, and I think it would have been awesome to see him run that one last race in his career in '88. So this is a good documentary. I'm done shilling for things that I saw over the past week. Daytona was...
I would say a good lead into that documentary is the actual 30 for 30 about Tim Richmond, about his career up to that point.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Like, in 86, he was just... Oh, he was kicking ass. He was even a former Indianapolis 500 Rookie of the Year back in 81.
Yeah. I'm like, if I recall correctly, he almost was Rookie of the Year that year.
Hmm.
I think that might cover us for Daytona. Who's ready for the Folds of Honor Quick Trip 500 and land? I guess not.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It always dies down. I like Atlanta. Atlanta's a fun race. I'd recommend watching it because there's going to be no other racing on that weekend, and the Olympics are going to be over by then. So, you know, it's there.
It's racing, you know.
It sure,
if you're that way inclined.
It has wheels and an engine, and they keep score, and that's not our motto, so we should move on to our next segment. We have some cars.
Yeah. I kind of like, time to talk about Formula One.
Yay. Woo!
Yay! Hype! We have Formula One stuff. We have cars. We have actual cars, and we have renderings of cars that will eventually be built into real cars.
So... I love that we're not even like pretending to like enjoy this bit. It's like, yay, the 2018 cars.
Let's start off with the most enjoyable bit of the car reveals was the ultimate honeypot from our favorite Formula One team, Aston Martin Red Bull Racing, powered by Tag Heuer.
Whose favorite F1 team? I'm sorry, whose?
Apparently the internet's now, because they love the new livery for the car.
It won't even race.
Yeah.
It's a testing-only livery. I wish it would race.
It's like Red Bull are cock-teasing us again.
Yep. Ultimate honeypot. Like, hey guys, here's our new livery that'll only be used for testing. Here's our great new livery.
It's like, I love that they said, like, oh, we're gonna try and keep some of the aero parts secret, as if Photoshop doesn't exist. It's like, if the teams will find a way to alter the filters so they can see exactly what they need to see.
People
like,
can put it in Photoshop. It ain't hard.
Like, ask Gareth, he's doing a bunch of videos about the series. God bless him. It's
never about hiding the car, because, like...
No.
It's viral marketing. It makes people excited about Red Bull Racing.
Right.
Exactly. Williams has a new FW41. I believe this is the first car entirely designed by Paddy Lowe since he went to the team. So there is optimism there, and at least the livery hasn't gotten too old for some. I still like the martini colors.
Yeah. I should.
I like the added black on the underbelly for what it's worth as well.
I should admit my favorite part about circling back quickly to the Red Bull story. Apparently, first run for the new car, the new RB14, Daniel Ricciardo crashed the car. So, the car was damaged enough that they had to stop running for the day, so they couldn't hit the 100-kilometer limit that you get for, you know, promotional filming purposes.
Oh, no.
So, like...
What a shame.
Yeah.
You can re-edit it that. You can create like a whole story with a narrative of like a driver who has a terrible crash but then comes back to race again.
Mm-hmm.
You could just grand tour that shit.
Sure, why not? So yeah, the cat, like, obviously I never heard stories about Ricciardo crashing the car, so I guess the camo livery is working to perfection. So yeah, good to know.
The most beautiful car from the rear angle is quite without question so far. It's the Alfa Romeo, the Alfa Romeo C37, the Alfa Romeo Sauber, because you get that lovely alpha red on the car. It just looks so magnificent, and then you turn it around.
Badass.
Oh my goodness. Oh no. You kept.
Oh god, this is still a Sauber. This is still a Sauber.
Oh no, it's It's like a literal case of that ass, and then you see the front, and it's like, oh no, what happened here?
Hey, baby, what's up? Ooh, okay. Right. Swipe right on this one.
I don't know, man. It's like, a part of me has always dreamed to have, like, a Ferrari in that sort of, like, white, with all of it in white, with the same Ferrari branding as usual. I've always thought that would be quite cool. Like, when people photoshopped the blue Ferrari last year, and I was like, I could get behind this. Like, again, there's a better chance of me marrying Ali Raceman than that actually ever happening. But, that rear end on that Sauber was a beautiful, beautiful thing. The rest of the livery, like, the fact they have very little sponsorship is only made worse by the fact it's white. It just makes it, like, that much more obnoxious to look
now,
at.
Now, hold on. They do have 90s apparel mega giant Kappa joining the team as a partner.
Kappa! Wow. You mean, like, you know what's kind of sad?
To the 90s, y'all.
You know what's quite sad? People will now more likely know Kappa as a Twitch emoji more than the actual clothing brand itself.
Okay, now I just want the Sauber to be covered in pictures of David Duchovny's face.
Right.
a montage of Kappa. It might actually look better than what they did with hodgepodging this car together. And of course, the most recent that we have is the Renault RS18. That's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous CGI. That's what that is.
It is just a rendering, but it's a lovely rendering. That yellow, that black, everything. King, your boy should be proud.
Yeah, and I love that my boys decided to sign even more of my boys, because Renault has announced that they've signed two new drivers. Their reserve driver is now Formula 2 driver Jack Aitken, and their test and development driver is Artem Markelov.
Wait, we got the mad Russian in? Yes!
As one Russian departs, another takes his place.
We have the mad Russian and that guy from Ara's My Driver series.
Nico Hülkenberg decided to actually color coordinate his helmet for a change. Good on you, lad.
I don't even know why he chose red. The fans chose red over green last year, and those guys were damn stupid. Like, also, on a side note, Marcus Ericsson's tribute livery to tribute helmet to Ronnie Peterson was fantastic. I absolutely love that.
If he just wore tribute helmets to Ronnie Peterson all the time, I think we would get over the notion of him being the absolute definition of F1 replacement level.
Word, like, later. I know, right? Like, just keep having awesome tribute helmets and more Swedish stuff.
When they did that for Monaco. John Eric Verne's Francois Sever helmet was just
perfect. That was fantastic. We like historical stuff on this show. But
we're all stuck in the past.
Give us back our V16s and our refueling. And our big spooling turbochargers, and our fuel tanks that literally explode if you flick them with your finger. Because that's what real racing was all about. I don't know.
Don't forget the grid goals, bro. But, yeah, so, geez. Favorite so far, fellas?
Renault.
Yeah, it's a clean sweep. I think the only issue is that their car looked I had a chat with Arav about this. Their car looks very simple, yeah. So it looks like they're probably not going to have their aero parts on that CGI rendering of the reveal of their car. But the suits are schnazzy, and I hope Carlos Sainz keeps his helmet design from last year, because that thing was a thing of beauty. And Hülkenberg being on brand was pretty nice. Shame it wasn't pink, just to troll himself a little bit there. But hey, we can't have it all. We can't have it all. Let's go from one FIA series to another. The WEC Super Season is almost here.
Super Season is almost here, y'all. We got 60 cars at Le Mans. We had an entry list of 9 cars. We had 69 cars at one point.
Nice.
Enter for Le Mans. Yes, indeed, it's very nice. And we have 10 LMP1s. Fun fact, if you take a sledgehammer to a Porsche 919 hybrid and break it up, it busts up into 8 neat non-hybrid LMP1s from the likes of Delara and Janetta and Orica.
Nice.
Yes, we have for Le Mans 30 prototypes, 30 GTs, and for the WEC we have 17 prototypes, I believe, and 17 GT cars. So I believe that makes it 34 for the full season, 60 for Le Mans. That's a good, healthy entry for a series that we were kind of worried about a little while ago.
Yes, sir. We've come a long way, people. And again, like when we first heard the news about Porsche quitting, I don't think anybody could have predicted that we would get this many teams on the board by then. That's kind of bonkers to me, but bonkers in a good way. Some of the names in there are absolutely stacked, for what it's worth. Like, geez, there's a lot of quality drivers in this field, Mr. O'Connell.
Yes, indeed. We've got Mikhail Lotion repping SMP Racing. We do have Andre Lotterer, Neil Yanni, both at Rebellion Racing.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. We've got Toyota. And Toyota is actually the talking point. It's the main takeaway from what we got out of the reveal of the 2018-2019 roster. Goodness, I'm going over some of the names. Oliver Rowland is in a manor. That's...
Yeah.
Ranger Vandersand is driving for Dragon Speed, the Americans. Oh, my goodness. But in the end, it all circles back to your one factory team, and it all circles back to Toyota, and it all circles back to a Spanish dude with long hair. Won a few races.
Your mans. Talk to us about your mans, RJ.
Fernando Alonso. Fernando Alonso is going to drive the full season of the WEC. He's also going to drive the full season of Formula One. King, how is he going to do all of that?
Oh, well, the ACO decided to make things easier for Fernando Alonso. They decided that the one conflict on his schedule where I believe the 6 hours of Fuji would have conflicted with the United States Grand Prix, they decided, hey, let's move the 6 hours of Fuji to an earlier date so Fernando can compete without any difficulty.
Right. I cannot see any problems with this whatsoever. Except for the fact that this now means that the 6 hours of Fuji now clashes with the Petit Le Mans, the IMSA season finale, on the very same weekend, an ocean away on the very same day. We don't have a Concorde replacement just yet, and Elon Musk is still worried about his flamethrowers, so we can't develop a new form of supersonic travel. So if you are somebody who has signed up to the North American Endurance Cup, for instance, along with your WEC contract, hello, Harry Ticknell, who is a double factory driver with Ford in the WEC and Mazda in IMSA. Oh, now you got to pick and choose. And if you're a works driver, they'll basically just tell you where to go. In the case, if you're a driver who doesn't have a works deal and is doing both races, knowing that at one point you could do both, now you can't do both.
Yeah, it's not ideal. It you're hurting paychecks. You're compromising contracts. It's not ideal for anybody involved, and a lot of the drivers involved in said clash have kicked up big stings about this onto Twitters.
Yeah, we should preface this by saying this is in no way, shape, or form Fernando Alonso's fault.
No.
It's the fault of the people who value Fernando Alonso.
God damn you, Toyota!
Yeah, because what was the ACO going to do when Toyota asked, "Hey, could you move this race back?" I'm like, "No, we've got too many contracts." Okay, what's our severance fee? Bye.
Yeah,
they kind of had to do them a solid, especially considering the 6 hours of Fuji is at Toyota's home track, and they're not just going to be like, okay, the biggest off-season acquisition that we got is not actually going to turn up, but we have an Anthony Davidson. Anthony Davidson of F1 2017 commentary fame.
Woo! Sigh, and triple sigh. It's not ideal, and it sucks for everybody, really. There's no winner here outside of Toyota who now get their mans for a full season, and I don't think you need me to tell you that I feel like the idea of basically compromising the contracts of many of your drivers on the field for the sake of one dude in an advertising pool is never going to go over well. And, you know, I don't think you should accommodate many crossover guys to, you know, prop up the chances of another crossover guy taking part, even if it is Fernando Alonso. But, like, King, it's not great, is it? Let's be honest. It's
no.
Kind of shitty for everybody.
From a sporting perspective, it is terrible. From a marketing perspective for the ACO, it's fantastic. Late capitalism is terrible, and that's why you pay $2 to get filtered water out of an app, but you can get tap water for free.
Oh dear. But yeah, it's not a good look. They were I wouldn't say they were in a no-win situation, but yeah, when you pretty much say, yeah, this conflict that we have with a single-seater championship, we're gonna, you know, avoid that, but also create a conflict with another sports car championship with a lot of our guys also participating. It's not a good look. It's not a good look.
But there's also an interesting story in that the very first year of the WEC, they had to change their calendar 4 or 5 times because of conflicts with Formula One. And yeah. just a couple of years ago, there was quite a big fuss when Nico Hülkenberg could not return to defend his 24 Hours of Le Mans title because Le Mans was clashing with Baku on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Baku solved that problem, so thanks, Baku.
Yeah, and it's not like...
They welcomed
them. It's not like WC and IMSA are, like, at complete odds with each other. Like, this isn't great. It doesn't help your relationship, but at the same time, IMSA was nice enough to be like... WC, you need an American round? Okay, we'll let you have an entirely new 12 hours of Sebring right after ours.
Yeah. And let's just say their relationship is already, like, not good. Like, it's not good.
It's fine. It's not like it's workable enough to where you can at least get guys like Corvette Racing. You still have IMSA automatic entries into the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Yes.
It's not like this is irreparable. It doesn't help, but at the same time, this is not going to be like the start of, like, oh goodness, well, IMSA and Corvette Racing are going to start the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Yeah, this is not a sports car version of the split. It's not that bad. But we are in a situation where pretty much where the new LMP1 regulations are going to be pretty much made with very little input from IMSA, and the ACO pretty much they want IMSA to adopt them to replace the Daytona Prototype International category eventually.
Right.
And also we're going to have BOP and LMP1 now. That's going to be a thing.
Oh, no, well, technically it was a thing already, but, yeah, basically they turned the equivalency of technology into a BOP rulebook.
Yeah, so if you fall afoul of the rulebook, again, unlike certain other publications, this is not, you know, the WEC trying to twist the arms and keep the privateer teams down, because they realized that if not for these privateers, there wouldn't be an LMP1 category. But if you fall afoul of the BMP, like, let's say, Land Motorsport did at the Rolex 24 at Daytona, even if all your shit is to the regulations, you can still get a stop and hold +5.
Yeah, which is... I my issue with it is the fact that there's a catch-all rule that pretty much, if the stewards want to penalize you because they feel like you're going too fast, they can.
Yeesh.
Yeah.
That seems a bit much.
Can we also talk about the driver rankings controversy? Because, my dude, in Pro-Am LMP2, G-Drive Racing is rolling out an all-pro lineup. And in LMP1, there's a 55-year-old gentleman driver.
Welcome to GT Yikes. Racing in a pro-am category.
Whoa. Wow. Like, who said the gentleman driver era is dead?
We had a gentleman driver in the Daytona 500. Shoutouts to Mark Thompson, 66 years old.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. He's old enough for his bus pass over here, and he's still driving race cars. What a guy. It's just because he's got enough money. And sometimes you could argue more money than sense. Oh, boy. Speaking of that, like, RJ, want to tell us a little bit about Rally Sweden?
What's this? Hold up. Let me look through the set list. Oh, yeah, Rally Sweden happened. Hazel Southwell was there. Thierry Neuville won for Hyundai, which as a Hyundai owner, this makes me very proud. Ireland's Craig Breen, by the way, was the star of the show for Citroën, and he finished second. That dude is en fuego right now, but nobody's talking about that because five-time and defending Sebastian OJ decided to galaxy brain the power stage.
I've not heard about this. What happened?
So, if you don't know, the World Rally Championship, they award, you know, the FIA-style point system like Formula 1, 25 for a win, down to 1 point for 10th. Though, there is the power stage. The final competitive stage of the rally offers its own special point system where I believe the top five guys get points.
You get top five now.
Yeah. So you win that stage, you get 5 points in the championship.
Uh-oh.
So, with Ogier out of contention for the rally, he was set to be one of the first runners out there on an unused track. It wasn't run on yet. So, basically, knowing that he was out of contention, decided to stall and miss his start time, incurring, you know, a time penalty for the rally outright. Though...
Sure.
He still gets to run the stage, not only after the WRC cars, but after all the other cars in the rally, like the national class cars, the club level cars. So he gets to run, like, dead last after, like, the stage is going to be the fastest it's going to be all day.
Everybody else has plowed the snow for him. And if you've driven Rally Sweden in any contemporary rally game, like anything from Codemaster, for instance... it's already kind of treacherous, and just imagine having to plow all the snow in front of you while you're driving that. That's not great.
So that is so fucking crafty.
He finished second.
Yeah, Ogier finishes second, gets 4 points on it. Like, he would have, after that day, if he had just ran the stage as normal, he probably would have left there with no points.
Oh no, he would have left it with one. He turned it into five.
Yeah, he turned it into five.
Wow. That is some crafty shit.
We do have to talk about other incidents that took place. Like, there was an on-stage collision between two of the WRC cars.
Oh my god, I heard about this. Oit Tanak of Toyota and Chris Meek of Citroën apparently had a dust-up.
Yeah, so Tanak was on it all weekend. Like... He was one of the outright fastest cars, but he had, like, incidents throughout that, including the collision. And he's going to, basically, he got impatient, because Meek was pretty slow at the time, Tanak was on it, and he needed to get around him. And he decided the moment he caught up to him, he was going to go for the pass. And Rally Sweden, there's like only like one lane through the massive piles of snow, and he decides to go for an overtake, and they collide.
And who said we were done talking about awkward collisions at the end of stages?
Tanak's car.
Never.
Tanak's car is beached. Meek's car is fairly fine. Meek continues on. Like, fans have to come and rescue Tanak's car.
This wouldn't even be the first time. Remember, this is the same man who literally drove into a lake.
Yeah, as a Toyota fan, I was sad.
Oh no, that is terrible yet hilarious. collisions in the WRC. What? That's not how this works. This isn't Sega Rally, people. Like, jeez.
What's next? Bump drafting in the WRC?
Sure. Push your man along through the tight 20-mile-an-hour hairpin. That'll speed him up a bit. Let's go. Oh, dear. Fellas, I think it's time we bring back an old feature.
What? What's coming back?
It's time for the mailbag!
Yes. Penis stored in the mailbag. Wait.
Come again?
Yes, it's your reader questions. We got a small mailbag because we got a condensed size mailbag. A fun size mailbag, if you will.
We're fun sized. Yeah, you know. It's covered in Black Panther branding now because, you know, it's on brand for modern blockbuster releases.
It's making over 200 mil in its opening weekend. That's amazing.
Fuck yes! I'm here for all this black excellence. Right, so, into the mailbag this week. And one from our friend of the show and yours, Charles Regible, who asks, which driver has the best Instagram stories?
We're not going to say Matt Shilton. That's exactly what he wants us to say.
That would be preposterous.
Oh, God.
Like, Zoe in our chat has just screamed willpower in the background.
Oh goodness, is it a bad time to admit that I don't follow a lot of Instagram stories of drivers?
I don't either, to be honest. Like, I don't follow a lot of drivers on Instagram. Like, racing drivers I follow on Instagram is like James Hinchcliffe and not much else. Like, I follow Carlos Munoz on Instagram, and like, there's not much else I actually follow on Instagram. Like, I don't use Instagram to really follow that many people besides mutual friends and shit. So, like, King never logs onto Instagram. That's
no.
For a fact.
No.
Nope. So, like, stop shouting Will in the background, Zoe, for fuck's sake. I don't even follow Will Power on Instagram, so I can't put an opinion out on this one. It's terrible. Like, we're not socially active enough around here, King, clearly.
Yeah, we're clearly in the olds camp.
Yeah. I'm just gonna say, just follow Hazel on Instagram, because she's way funnier than most people on there anyway. So, follow Hazel on Instagram. Hazel _ Southwark. She's hilarious. So go with that, basically. Sorry if I butcher your name here, Usmar. I hope I pronounced that right. Apologies if I didn't. If you could put a Grade 1/Grade A circuit anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Queens, New York.
Stop. What is wrong with you?
Hey, I'm extremely biased.
Of course.
goodness. What's like a nice suburb of London? Because that seems to be what everybody wants.
Stick it in West London, like roughly the Southall sort of area, so I don't have to leave my bedroom window to watch the race itself. Like, that would be pretty gangster. If you ask me, we've got a couple of nice dirt back alleyways as well, which is fun.
And it would still provide better racing than Battersea.
Sure. You know, we'll turn it into a rallycross stage.
Oh my goodness.
So that'll be fun. Any suggestions on your end, RJ? Besides coming down here for the London Grand Prix?
Let's see. Put one up in, like, I don't know. I want to say, like, maybe somewhere in and around Los Angeles.
Yeah, that sounds like...
That'd be pretty cool. That'd be pretty cool.
Get that L.A. market exposure, baby.
Yeah.
We'll settle for Port Imperial.
You know, be like hometown hero Lewis Hamilton's here to win a Grand Prix.
R.I.P. Yeah. R.I.P. Port Imperial.
Oh, yeah.
R.I.P. indeed.
Too ambitious for this world.
The world wasn't ready for you yet. Oh dear.
Osama Adamea has another question for us.
Sure.
What is the most entertaining yet farcical race you've ever watched in, we'll basically just say any series. So off the top of our head, F1.
Ooh, I really have to say that season one finale for Formula E.
Oh, wow. I would happily have said season two with basically the whole championship coming down to a time trial.
The time trial finale.
The time trial finale. IndyCar
2011 New Hampshire. That's a very, very good one. Considering how clusterfucky the end of that race got to. Might I put in a suggestion for the 2008 Brickyard 400 where nobody could go more than 5 or 7 laps without a tire blowing and a caution coming out?
Yeah, MotoGP, Phillip Island 2013 with the first ever flag-to-flag race because the diamond cut the track and no bike was safe for more than 10 laps. And Repsol Honda very nearly cost Marc Marquez the title because they couldn't count to 10.
Yes,
that was fun.
Yes, and before anybody asks, yes, that United States Grand Prix. That United States Grand Prix that me and my family got to saw in person.
In person.
Can we?
You mean 2000? You mean 2006?
2005.
I'm joking.
Another good one. NOLA Motorsports Park, IndyCar's only venture to New Orleans.
Yeah, that was supposed to be like a staple on the calendar. They were like, because they only used like half the circuit for the first event, and they were consulting with IndyCar about the design for the second half. And it was supposed to be a staple for years, and it's one event and gone.
Stated the art, but then it just rained. It rained all damn day. The race didn't even get to halfway, I think. At least Hinchcliffe
Yikes.
Won it. James Hinchcliffe, eternal winner of the Indy Grand Prix of Louisiana.
Woo!
Undefeated in New Orleans.
Undefeated. Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. Though, I do have to pull one farcical race out of the great bag of history. The 1926 French Grand Prix held on a 5-kilometer-long oval in the south of France.
Lit!
It sounds good on paper. Of the, I believe, dozen or so entrants to the race, only 3 actually turned up. And only 1 car went the full distance.
Well, sounds like Canada 2011 all over again. Oh boy, there's a couple of crazy ones as well. Zoe in the chat also mentioned the Texas double and the lottery to decide the lineup for the second race. Yikes, that doesn't sound fun. That doesn't sound pretty. That sounds like a mess. Didn't Henry send in a question as well, RJ?
I'm skimming through the tweets here. We got a few tweets. Please add us at motorsport underscore 101. We have one from Jason Poland, which we did kind of cover. Rate the Alfa Sauber livery on a scale of 1 to 10.
4.
I'll give her face a 2, and ass a 9.
RJ, you still need to objectifying of cars, for God's sake, man. Get a grip.
Okay, I just need something that'll bring me some excitement, because why else would I turn up to a race if not to see, like, beautiful, gorgeous cars? So, please sign my petition. I'm very desperate for attention.
Is it the same one that Barney's passing around to bring back the darts walk-on girls back?
No,
is that
this is a different one. This is a different petition. I don't think we got. Yeah, like I said, I think that might have covered all of our questions in our very fun-sized mailbag.
There's one more. So I was looking for Henry Chapman's tree, and I found it. It says, I replied to RJ's tree, but I'll ask again. Who should replace DW in the Fox NASCAR booth?
Well, the guy I would have suggested is already contracted NBC.
Yeah, me too.
I'm guessing that's Dale, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
thought so. Just want to confirm.
I'm honestly drawing a blank. How about for comedy's sake, Troy Aikman?
Oh God!
Oh my God! If they could pull off the deal, I'd really prefer Tony Romo.
Right.
Oh my goodness.
Oh dear. What one more one as well, because Zoe's determined to bombard this podcast from the outside. Last minute question: who's winning and who's coming last in this year's Penske Games?
Oh, geez, that might be the most important motorsport contest, the most important championship of the season.
Yes, it is.
It's going to be lit. Like my money is like, I'm going to go for the dark horse pick here. I'm going to say Juan Pablo Montoya and his multiple faceted skills will find a way to get this done.
Give me Pagenaud, and I think he's going to walk it this year.
The man who finished stone dead last year.
It's time for the comeback. It's time for the ultimate comeback. If Leicester City can win the Premier League, Simon Pagenaud can win the Penske Games.
Oh dear! Like who knows? Like Helio's got two chances because he's trying for two different teams now as well. But I can't wait for the Penske Games. It's going to be fantastic. I cannot wait for that season two. It starts, I believe, March 7th. So keep an eye on Team Penske's Twitter account for that one.
And my pick is my namesake, Ryan Blaney.
Blaney, yes, that's a solid pick.
The he's other a good half of Team Super Best Friends.
Yes.
Yay. Yeah.
Oh, that's the one thing I forgot to touch on in Daytona. We didn't get a Super Best Friends 1-2 finish. We'll get it someday. I have
soon.
Faith.
Soon.
Any order is soon.
And one last question from Zoe. In honor of Andretti Autosport's President Day video, you shameless fangirl, how many U.S. presidents can you name?
let's save that for another episode.
Yep. Okay, we'll say that for in a fortnight's time, because, you know, Ryan King being the historian, he's bound to, like, basically run the table like Will Power did, going through the alphabet backwards, like during season one of the Penske Games. But I think we're just about done here, ladies and gentlemen. We kept it dinky, under an hour and a half, which is actually going against my bet that I had before the show that I reckon we'd find a way to go over. We didn't! Go us! We're getting better at this whole podcast thing now. Places you can find us one more time. They're on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter @motorsport_101. Our personal handles @Harrison101HD, @RJ O'Connell. And that Ryan Eric King. If you really, really like us, you can back us on Patreon. Patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to both this show and Bike Live. Both episodes of Bike Live. Although I did want to point a small asterisk on that. There will not be early access for the season preview because we're going to be tight for time recording that one. So as soon as it is finished, we will put it straight up on our SoundCloud no matter what time it is. So stay tuned around late Thursday, early Friday morning for it. So as I said, Bike Life World Superbike season preview for 2018 will be up sometime around Friday night. Again, Greg Haynes will be on it as well, and Rebecca James will be back, most likely, on that show as well. So, you know, all you Bex fans out there, you get her yearly appearance. enjoy that one. I've been Andre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Ryan King. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all. Bye.